Ladies, do things ever seem a bit off down there? If you're dealing with vaginal odour or excessive itch, then you're not alone. It's estimated that 1 in 3 women are. It's about time we removed the mystery from feminine health and confronted it head on. Meet Flower Power, a natural vegan vaginal suppository that helps rebalance things downstairs. It's time to naturally restore your vagina's self-cleansing powers. Flower Power contains boric acid, an oceanic mineral that has been used for hundreds of years for its acidic, antiviral, and antifungal properties. Flower Power products are backed by doctors, cruelty-free, vegan, and made in the USA. Flower Power is simple to use and it's incredibly fast-acting. A reduction in odour can be noticed in as little as one use. So head on over to getflowerpower.com or click the link in my show notes. Make sure to use the code MYSTERY for 10% off your order. Once again, that's getflowerpower.com and coupon code MYSTERY. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. What lengths would a parent go to have their child's body returned to them? Would you let your child's killer go free so that you could be reunited with their body? Sadly, when Matthew Levison vanished in 2007, his parents would be faced with this unimaginable scenario. Matthew Levison was a 20-year-old man living in the Cronulla area of New South Wales, Australia. He had grown up in the area and had attended Innaburra School in Bangor. He was known as a happy-go-lucky party boy that loved nothing more than hanging out with his friends and dancing. He had come from an extremely close-knit family, and when he came out as gay 4 years earlier, his parents, Mark and Faye, said that they were not surprised. They said that from an early age, they knew that Matthew was different.
We knew since he was 4 years old.
It wasn't a shock.
We knew. We don't care. It doesn't change who he is.
No problem, bro.
Mark and Faye were extremely supportive of Matthew, and he knew that he could be himself around his family. He was the middle child and was a wonderful brother to Peter and Jason. One friend, Rachel Sankey, said that when you were with Matthew, there was never a dull moment. He just wanted to make the most out of life and always made sure to enjoy every single moment. In 2007, Matthew had truly landed on his feet and had started a new job as a call centre worker in Hurstville. Financially stable, Matthew had been looking at term deposits for a new investment and was looking into buying a new car. On the 25th of September 2007, Matthew was reported missing when he did not show up to work. The first point of action for investigators was to try and establish Matthew's last known movements. It was quickly discovered that Matthew hadn't been seen since the night of the 22nd of September. He'd spent the night with a group of friends at Ark Nightclub on Flinders Street in Surrey Hills. While here, he bumped into his older brother, Peter, who said that he appeared to be his normal, bubbly self. He said that his brother came across as happy and was dancing around the nightclub like he normally did. Peter said, "He was with his friends, and they are really lovely people. There was nothing out of the norm at all." Matthew left the nightclub in the early morning hours of the 23rd of September. He was seen walking out of the club with his middle-aged boyfriend, Michael Peter Atkins. Matthew and Michael had been dating for around 1 year, with Matthew eventually moving in to Michael's apartment in Cronulla. According to Michael, they returned home to the apartment and slept in until around 2 p.m. or 3 p.m. He said that Matthew had spoken to him about going out with some friends later that evening. Michael had fallen asleep on the couch while watching television, and when he awoke later on, Matthew was gone. He believed that Matthew had simply gone out with the friends he told him that he was going to go out with, and thought nothing of it. The following morning, Michael sent a text message to Matthew, which read, "Good morning, baby. Where are you? I woke up and you were not in bed. Did you go out? Let me know where you are. Miss you, XXX." He followed up with text messages throughout the day, inquiring as to where Matthew was. However, he received no reply. When Matthew's co-worker informed his parents that he didn't show up for work the next morning, they and Michael filed a missing person report. 2 days after Matthew was reported missing, his car was discovered parked outside the public toilets at Warada Park Reserve in Rawson Avenue, Sutherland. The car was a green 1999 Toyota Seca hatch, and investigators were quick to ask the public if anybody had seen the car in the area to please get in contact. They were wanting to determine whether Matthew had driven the car to that area or whether somebody else had. Inspector Adam Barwick stated that Matthew's car had been driven to the reserve between the 23rd and 24th of September. However, he said that evidence suggested that Matthew wasn't driving the car, but instead, somebody else was. Following the update in the case, investigators announced that they feared that Matthew may have been the victim of foul play. Investigator Barwick said, "If you picked anyone up from the park that day or gave someone a lift from the area, please contact police." Matthew's friends and family quickly got to printing out missing person flyers and sending out mass emails. One email read, "Our dear friend Matthew Levison is missing. It is still not too late. Please help us." Matthew was last seen wearing light brown cargo pants, a black singlet, and white leather shoes. Matthew had been an avid MySpace user, but his account had fallen silent from the day he vanished. A number of his friends, however, had been posting on his wall, asking him to get in contact to let everybody know where he was and whether he was safe. One message read, "Love you, Maddie. Come home soon. I miss you more than words can describe." Another read, "Maddie, I miss you. Where the hell are you? Please come home safely. I'm praying for you." They assembled search teams who scoured the Colonel Sandhills and Royal National Park bushland looking for Matthew or even some kind of clue which could assist in their search, potentially an item of clothing. Matthew's parents made an emotional plea on television for the safe return of their son. His mother, Faye, broke down in tears as she said, "I want my son back. He's a beautiful boy. He wouldn't harm a fly. Please, if you heard something that night, that morning, please come to police and tell them." Within less than a week, investigators stated that there was no evidence that Matthew was still alive, and announced that they were now searching for a body. They further stated that they had not yet ruled out that Matthew could have become the victim of a hate crime. By November, investigators announced that the case had shifted from a missing person investigation to a homicide investigation. While they were working around the clock to try and find Matthew's body and determine what had happened to him, his parents once again made a public announcement. They stated that they had come to the painful realization that Matthew very likely wasn't coming home. According to investigators, they believed that Matthew had been murdered and that his killer had dumped his car in front of the public toilets to throw the investigation off. The area was a popular meeting place for gay men, but as Mark said, while Matthew was openly gay, it was not the kind of area that he would ever go to. December was an extremely tough month for Matthew's family. First of all, it was Matthew's 21st birthday on the 12th of December. Matthew had been planning a massive party, but instead, the family had a quiet dinner and a drink in Matthew's honour. Then when Christmas rolled round, Faye and Mark were unsure if they should write Matthew's name on the family Christmas cards. While investigators had told them that Matthew had most likely been murdered, still, no body had been found and a suspect had not yet been identified. In a way, the family were in limbo. Matthew absolutely loved Christmas, and Faye would joke that their house was more lit up than Santa's grotto. But this year, Matthew wasn't there to decorate the house or the tree. There would be no update in the case until August of the following year, when it was announced that a 45-year-old man had been arrested in connection with Matthew's disappearance. The following day, everybody was stunned to discover that the man who had been arrested was no other than Matthew's boyfriend, Michael Peter Atkins. While Michael had been questioned by investigators, he had denied any knowledge in the disappearance of his boyfriend.
And then Sunday was sort of like fairly normal, and we sort of came home, and then watched Idol on TV, and I fell asleep in the lounge, watching sort of TV, and woke up a little while later, and he wasn't home. So I sent him a text and said, where are you, whatever. And I didn't really worry about it too much because he doesn't work on Mondays.
Yeah.
And he's got a group of friends that he goes out with.
Yeah. What happened on Sunday? What time did you wake up?
In the afternoon sometime, about 2 o'clock or something. 2 or 3.
Yeah.
And then we sort of just had, lazy Sunday afternoon, really.
Did you wake up together?
Yeah, pretty much, I think.
Mm-hmm. So you got up?
No. This has water. Didn't have much, I think. And I think just had some juice. And
did Matthew eat?
No.
And then what happened?
We just sort of spent a lazy day, so sat around the unit and
did you leave the unit at all?
I think once or twice.
Did you go there?
Oh, I think I just left. Go for a walk. To the mall. To the mall.
What time would that have been?
In the afternoon sometime. I don't know, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. Somewhere.
Okay. So from the time you went to sleep at 5 to the time you wake up at 2, obviously you were in the unit the whole time?
Yep.
And Matthew?
Yeah, I assume so.
To your knowledge?
To my knowledge.
He didn't leave?
Yeah.
And was it the first time you left the unit about 5 o'clock?
Yeah, I think
on
so.
On Sunday? To go for a walk down the mall?
Yep.
Did you buy anything?
Don't think so.
Yep. Okay. Well, Michael just wished to inform you that earlier today we located a green Toyota Corolla, which is, we understand, is Matthew's car. Do you understand that?
Yeah.
Okay. And that car was found at Waratah Oval in Sutherland. Is there anything you can say about that?
Don't think so.
Is there anything that comes to mind when we tell you that we've located his car at Waratah Oval?
Not really.
Okay. I've become aware that Waratah Oval is a meeting point of some regard for the gay community.
Okay.
Michael, are you in any way connected with the disappearance of Matt Leveson?
No.
Is there anything else that you wish to say about Matt and his disappearance?
No.
Do you know where Matt is now?
No.
The arrest came as a complete shock to Matthew's family, with Mark and Faye stating that they felt betrayed and sick to their stomach to discover that somebody Matthew loved and trusted had been arrested for his murder. When it was time for Michael to appear in court to be charged with the murder, he refused to leave his cell, prompting Mark to refer to him as a coward for not confronting Matthew's family. In his absence, he was charged with the murder of Matthew, and it was revealed that investigators believed that Michael had murdered Matthew at some point between 3:30 a.m. after they left the nightclub and noon. Michael would be ordered to stand trial for Matthew's murder, and the date was set for the 5th of June 2009. However, the case would be pushed back until September. During trial, it would be revealed that Michael had been on investigators' radar from the very first day of the investigation. They had kept extremely tight-lipped about the entire investigation, and during the trials, details would finally float to the surface. During opening statements, prosecutor Chris Maxwell put forward the theory that Michael and Matthew had gotten into an argument while at the ARC nightclub because Matthew didn't want to leave. At 3:30 a.m. that morning, Matthew had sent a text message to a friend who had been at the nightclub with them, stating, "Mike's having a fucking cry. He is taking me home and won't let me stay. He needs to fucking get over himself." The relationship between Matthew and Michael had been marred by jealousy and blazing rows. Early on in the trial, it was revealed that in the months leading up to Matthew's disappearance, Michael had been selling drugs, including ecstasy, speed, ketamine, GHB, cocaine, and sleeping pills. In addition to selling drugs, Michael was also known to trade drugs. An unidentified witness testified that he had traded drugs with Michael between 2006 and 2007. He said that he had supplied Michael with ecstasy around a dozen times and typically sold him around 100 tablets at a time. He also stated that he had sold cocaine to Michael on occasion and had purchased GHB, ketamine, speed, and sleeping tablets from him. Quite often, Michael would meet the unidentified witness at a McDonald's car park in Blacktown for the exchange. He said that on occasion, Matthew would be with Michael when the exchanges took place. Trent Nathan Scott was then called to testify. According to Trent, he had seen both Matthew and Michael counting ecstasy pills or vials of GHB on a number of occasions before going to the ARC nightclub. He further stated that he had seen both Matthew and Michael counting several $1,000 that they had made from selling drugs at the nightclub. He said that he had met with Michael and Matthew on several occasions near the Cronulla railway station near their apartment to purchase ecstasy. Following their testimony, further testimony would be presented from mutual acquaintances of both Matthew and Michael, who stated that Michael was seen partying in the weeks after Matthew's disappearance. Gregory Rogers, who was an ex-boyfriend of Michael, said that he had bumped into Michael on the 6th of October at the sleazeball and said that Michael was clearly under the influence of drugs and had offered him GHB. The following day, the two men met at a Sydney hotel for sex. Gregory had met Michael online when he was just 17 years old, and the two started having casual sex. Another man would also testify that he had met Michael online when he was 17 years old, back in 2005, and that they too started having casual sex. But then following Matthew's disappearance, Michael began contacting him more frequently. It would be revealed during trial that Faye and Mark had learned that Michael was out partying just weeks after their son's disappearance. They met with Michael in early 2008, and Mark had worn a concealed recording device.
He went and saw Atkins at his apartment and sat with him. Poor Faye gave the bastard a hug and a kiss. I had to shake his hand.
I had to sit there and look at him and watch him scratch and sweat and lie.
Boy, was he nervous. I was just trying to think of what to ask that would help the investigation.
During the meeting, they confronted Michael about being at the sleazeball just weeks after Matthew had vanished. According to Michael, he had been there looking for Matthew. But as other witnesses said, he clearly wasn't looking for Matthew. He was under the influence of drugs and was partying like he didn't have a care in the world. Just the day before Matthew vanished, he had complained to his friend and workmate, Carrie-Anne Wadd, that Michael had wanted to have threesomes and that he believed that he was God's gift to men. Matthew had confided in Carrie-Anne on several occasions that he had had enough of Michael and his jealous attitude. Despite the fact that he was overly jealous of any attention that Matthew received, he had wanted Matthew to pick up younger men and then have group sex. This was something that Matthew confessed to Carrie-Anne, that he had done, but also admitted that it was something that he didn't like doing and something that he had been pressured into doing. She described how on one occasion in September, Matthew struggled to hold in tears as he told her about what had happened at a party they had attended. He told her that while at the party, Michael had pushed him into a wall and that it had hurt. Then the day before he vanished, Matthew told Carrie-Anne that he had finally had enough of Michael and the relationship and that he was going to stand his ground. After leaving the nightclub on that fateful night, Matthew had sent a number of text messages to Brendan Matthew Kent, indicating that there had been some kind of argument between him and Michael that night. He confessed that on two occasions he had group sex with Matthew and Michael. The day after Matthew and Michael had been at the nightclub, Michael claimed that Matthew told him that he was going to go out with friends. He identified those friends and they were called to testify during trial. On the witness stand, they all denied that there had been any arrangements made for them to go out and that they had not been contacted by Matthew at all. As it would be revealed, when Matthew's car was discovered, it had been wiped clean of fingerprints and a bulky subwoofer had been removed from the trunk of the car. The speaker had been replaced by a Bunnings Caramba receipt for a Matic and a roll of duct tape. Upon finding the receipt, investigators went to the store to review their security footage from 12:21 p.m. on the 23rd of September, which was the date and time of the receipt. The footage clearly showed Michael purchasing a Matic and duct tape, which investigators alleged was used to help dispose of Matthew's body. However, when Michael was questioned, he claimed that the man in the footage was not him, and that he and Matthew were asleep at that time, stating that they slept in until 2 p.m. or 3 p.m. Investigators believed that the subwoofer had been removed from Matthew's car so that his body could fit into the trunk, and then the Matic was used to aid in digging a grave. As I mentioned earlier in the episode, Michael had texted Matthew a number of times, inquiring where he was and when he was coming home. One of the messages read, "Baby, no matter what happened, just give me a call. We're all worried sick." Matthew's phone had been discovered in Michael's car. According to Prosecutor Maxwell, Michael had the phone. He knew those messages weren't getting through. He suggested that Michael was playing the part of a concerned lover, but knew all too well that Matthew would never be responding. When Faye testified, she sobbed as she told the jury that the family had trusted Michael. She said that they first met him at a family function at the Rheindorf restaurant at Beverly Hills. She said that Michael was extremely controlling of Matthew. She said that Matthew became more withdrawn as Michael became more guarding of him. She said that as the relationship grew, when Matthew would say goodbye to her, he would hold on to her that little bit tighter and that little bit longer and tell her that he loved her. On the witness stand, she said, Michael wouldn't let him out of his sight. I'd walk into the kitchen to be alone with Matthew, and he'd follow. The case against Michael had been one based on circumstantial evidence. There had been no physical evidence which tied him to Matthew's disappearance. In fact, there was no real direct evidence that Matthew was actually dead. There was no blood, no weapon, no crime scene, so to speak. During closing arguments, Prosecutor Maxwell said that in the wake of Matthew's disappearance, Michael tried to appear like the concerned boyfriend. However, his actions showed his true colours. Within just days, he was out at nightclubs, meeting up with young men, taking them back to hotel rooms, taking drugs, and having sex. He told the jury to think back to the text message that Michael had sent to Matthew, telling him that he was worried sick. He said that the very same morning, Michael had sent three text messages to another man, who he had regularly been having sex with, throughout his relationship with Matthew. If he was beside himself with worry, why would he be going to clubs and having sex with other men? Prosecutor Maxwell reminded the jury that Matthew had been in a controlling relationship with Michael. He had forced him into having group sex and had forced him to bring other young men into their relationship. He ended his statement with, Matthew Levison says he is going to stand his ground. Matthew Levison is never seen again. During the defense's closing arguments, attorney Keith Chappell suggested that despite the fact that Matthew had not been seen, had not been heard from, and had not used his bank account since he vanished, he could still be alive. He suggested that there were a number of potential explanations for his disappearance, many of which centered around drug dealing. He said, "This is not a drug case, but there are a lot of drugs in it." He put forward the theory that Matthew may have been the victim of foul play at the hands of a drug supplier, or could have accidentally died of a drug overdose. He even suggested that Matthew may have met foul play when visiting Wirata Park, where his car had been found. According to attorney Chappell, Michael had purchased the mattock because he wanted to plant some vegetables near his apartment, and the mattock hadn't been discovered during a search of his apartment simply because the search that investigators had conducted wasn't good enough. Before ending his closing argument, he suggested that Matthew may have even faked his own disappearance to teach Michael a lesson. He stated, "Can you rule these explanations out? Because if you cannot, if you are left with even one, it is a problem." Following the closing arguments, Supreme Court Justice Peter Hidden outlined the case against Michael. He said that the prosecution and the defence agreed on most of the facts surrounding Matthew's disappearance, but they differed on the conclusions that were drawn. Afterwards, he sent the jury away to deliberate. After almost a week, the jury sent a note to Supreme Court Justice Peter Hidden, which read, "We are at an impasse and are unable to reach a decision unanimously." He offered the jury an option to deliver a majority verdict, but that verdict required that 11 out of the 12 jurors agreed on the verdict. The following day, the jury reached a verdict. They found Michael Peter Atkins not guilty of murder. Matthew's family were completely stunned. Outside of court, his father, Mark, said that they were profoundly disappointed with the verdict. They vowed that they would never give up searching for their son. In the years following the trial, they continued their search. They wrote numerous letters to authorities begging for the case to be reopened. Speaking with the local media, Mark said, "We want to bring Matty home and lay him to rest properly and his killer brought to justice before we also die." As the years passed, the grief and heartache never dwindled. In fact, every birthday, every Mother's Day, every Father's Day, and every Christmas became more difficult. They had spent numerous hours searching through bushland for their son's body. Mark said, I ask myself, if I had to dispose of a body, how would I do it? I don't want to think about it, but I have to. They felt as though they had searched practically everywhere, especially places where a car could be parked nearby.
They've searched the length of this road right to the end, looking for places where you can park a car, get out into the bush and hide a body.
In the early days, and it still is heart-wrenching, heartbreaking, but in the early days you go out there and you cry, you look and you just cry and you think, where do you start? Where do you start? And it's just looking for a needle in a haystack.
They strongly believe that Matthew had been stuffed into his own car to be disposed of. Mark, Faye, and Matthew's two brothers all got memorial tattoos of Matthew. Underneath a portrait of his son, Mark got the quotes, "Death leaves a heartache that no one can heal," and "Love leaves a memory that no one can steal." Today's episode of Morbidology is sponsored by Liquid Death, and I don't think that I could think of a more appropriate sponsor. Liquid Death is 100% mountain water from the Alps. As I'm sure most of you are aware, most major bottled water brands are processed municipal tap water, not Liquid Death. It comes from a deep underground mountain source protected by a few hundred feet of stone. What's also amazing about this product is that they are anti-plastic. Instead of a plastic bottle, Liquid Death uses an aluminium can, which contains over 70% recycled material. Even better, 10% of the profits from every can sold is donated to help heal plastic pollution. Liquid Death are bringing death to plastic and murdering your thirst in one can. So head on over to liquiddeath.com or Whole Foods and make sure to check them out. Christmas is fast approaching and it's time to start thinking about gifts. 2020 has been a strange year, to say the very least, and I know a lot of us are wanting Christmas to be that extra bit special this year. So how about, instead of getting the same run-of-the-mill presents for your loved ones, why not get them something amazing and unique? WYLD Gallery has the perfect solution. This gallery features fine art by Native American artists. The art is bright, bold and pop style, and some paintings even have a little historical tension thrown in. All of the paintings at WYLD Gallery explore heritage, culture and tradition, and a number of their artists have art featured in the permanent collections of a number of museums, including the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. and New York City. What's amazing about this gallery is that it's all available online. There's no need to venture out to the shops. Just head on over to wyld.gallery or click the link in my show notes to have a look at some of the cool paintings that they have. Not only are you getting a gorgeous painting for your loved one or even for yourself, but you're supporting Native American artists during Native American Heritage Month. In early 2012, investigators announced a $100,000 reward for information that could lead to Matthew's body. Police Detective Inspector Rohan Cramsey said that he had hoped that reward would tempt somebody who knew something to finally come forward. He said, "There is a person or people out there who knows what happened to Matt. We're appealing for them to come forward with information that will allow the Levison family closure and the ability to bury their son." It was the first time that a reward had been offered for a dead body in New South Wales, and it had been a long time coming. Mark and Faye had campaigned for 18 months to convince police to offer a reward. They had numerous setbacks, and a number of family members of other victims had warned them that rewards were often pointless and rarely successful. That didn't deter them, however, and they thought that if there was even the slight chance that it could lead to Matthew's body, then it was worth pursuing. Then in mid-2015, a confession on social media sparked hope in the hearts of Matthew's parents. In a series of postings online, a man claimed that he had murdered Matthew and even went into great detail. The confession sparked a thorough investigation, but it turned out that it was complete fabrication. The man wasn't charged because of the statute of limitations. When he was questioned, he said that he had hoped the messages would force the case to be reopened. Towards the end of 2015, more information regarding the case was publicised during an inquest. It was revealed that after an interview with investigators, Michael had said, "I want to tell you, but I'm scared of what will happen to me if I do." The purpose of the inquest was to look at a broader range of evidence than what was presented during Michael's trial, but it was stressed that no matter what the outcome of the inquest, Michael's acquittal would remain. A number of text messages were also presented as evidence during the inquest. 2 weeks before Matthew disappeared, Michael had sent a text message to another man which read, "If I wasn't with Matt, I'd be with you." The man, who wasn't publicly identified, said that he had threesomes with the couple, but said that he was closer to Matthew. He said that Matthew had confided in him that Michael was controlling and wouldn't let him go out alone. He also stated that Michael used Matthew to get close to younger men, who he then supplied with drugs. Another man testified that just days after Matthew had vanished, Michael texted him, inviting him to the sleazeball. The man said that he was extremely surprised by the invitation because he thought that Michael was with Matthew. The man wasn't aware that Matthew was missing and that everybody had been searching for him. Michael told him that Matthew would be going to the sleazeball with his own friends and that they would all meet up once there. The following day, a friend of the man told him that Matthew was missing and presumed dead. During the inquest, he said, "It was a big discomfort for me that this had happened and that I had no idea about it." His testimony was followed by testimony from another man who said that just days after Matthew vanished, Michael had driven to Newcastle to have sex with him. In a bizarre twist in the case, as the inquest was unfolding in court, a box of missing evidence in the case was discovered in the roof of a former police officer's home. The discovery raised hopes that the missing piece of the puzzle could be uncovered. Sadly, however, there was no smoking gun found in the box of evidence, so to speak. It was mostly secret recordings which contained no confession, and CCTV footage from the ARC nightclub. In May, it was announced that Michael would be compelled to give evidence for the very first time. The inquiry had led to Deputy State Coroner Elaine Truscott ruling that there were circumstances that she found to be exceptional and compelling, and that only Michael could clear these circumstances up. She had reached the conclusion that Michael knew much more about Matthew's disappearance than he was letting on. However, the victory was hollow because his evidence and testimony would be under protection of immunity, which meant that it could not be used against him in any future criminal proceedings. Similar offers are mostly used for minor offences, but this was unprecedented. Never in Australian history had this taken place, and essentially Michael could confess to murder on the witness stand and still not be charged. Outside of court, Mark said, "This is what the system has forced us to do. We had to decide whether we wanted to bring Matt home or get a murder conviction. We've always said from the start that we want to bring Matt home." Deputy State Coroner Elaine Truscott ordered that Michael come to court and present evidence in October. She detailed the evidence which she believed connected Michael to Matthew's disappearance, including the fact that he was captured on CCTV purchasing a mattock and tape. Following the announcement, Michael desperately attempted to have the inquest stopped. His lawyers wanted to overturn the decision for Michael to give evidence and filed a summons in the New South Wales Supreme Court, accusing Deputy State Coroner Elaine Truscott of exceeding her statutory powers under the Coroner's Act of 2009. His last-ditch attempt failed, and Michael was ordered to give evidence. In October, Michael appeared in court. He had remained silent up until this very point, and now he was legally not allowed to stay silent. During his testimony, Michael stated that he loved Matthew and had looked after him over the course of their relationship. He admitted that he had sex with two other men just days after Matthew vanished. When he was asked what he had done to search for Matthew, he replied with, "Not a great deal. I went and looked for him on that Monday. I think I looked on the internet." Counsel Lester Fernandez suggested to Michael that he knew that Matthew was dead, to which he replied, "No, I always thought he went to Thailand." He put forward the theory that Michael had gone to Thailand and started a new life. In regards to the matter, Michael claimed that he was planning on digging a vegetable plot beside his apartment, despite the fact that he had not sought permission to do so. He admitted that he had lied to police initially when he denied that he had purchased a mattock and duct tape, despite the fact that the receipt had been found in Matthew's car and had contained Michael's fingerprints. Neither the mattock or the duct tape was ever found.
It's our belief that you went to Bunnings Warehouse and you were the person who purchased that pig and that gaffer tape. Is there anything you wish to say about that?
Don't think it was me.
Who do you think it could be?
I don't know.
CCTV footage was presented which showed Michael and Matthew leaving the Ark nightclub at 2:11 a.m. The same camera then showed Michael returning to the club alone at 3:06 a.m, speaking briefly to a man and then leaving again. Michael claimed that he had no recollection of this conversation and that he could not account for his movements during those 55 minutes. He had claimed earlier on that he and Matthew had left the nightclub and went straight home. Midway through the inquest, the New South Wales Attorney General personally agreed to grant immunity from prosecution to Michael in return for Matthew's body. The extremely rare decision raised questions over the original investigation and trial. It had come after Michael was threatened with perjury charges after he admitted to lying under oath. He had been granted immunity on the perjury charge if he revealed where Matthew's body was. Matthew's family had been consulted on the arrangement and had agreed with it, because they wanted nothing more than to have their son's body back. Mark and Faye had felt gutted, and in a way, they felt betrayed. Understandably, they felt as though the system had made them choose between getting their son back where he belonged and letting Michael get away with murder. Using their head and not their hearts, they agreed to the deal. Following the agreement, Michael directed investigators to an area within the Royal National Park. Now, the search was truly on to find Matthew's body. The update was a tremendous step into finally uncovering what had happened to Matthew, and the area that investigators were now searching had been an area that Matthew's family had searched numerous times. It's a very large area, so when they were searching all the preceding years, they could have just been feet away from their son. The deal that Michael had made was the very first in Australian history. A mechanical excavator was used to dig trenches in a grid system within a cordoned off area in the park. By day three, Matthew's body had still not been recovered. His parents said that they would remain there until they found their son. They said that they had made a promise to Matthew 9 years ago that they would bring him home. However, after a week-long search, Matthew's body had not been recovered. The deal was conditional on the recovery of Matthew's body. This meant that Michael was potentially facing a perjury charge. As the excavator backed away, Faye sunk to the ground and started to sob. She was clutching a laminated photograph of Matthew, which she had intended on placing on the ground when his body was finally found. Sadly, it wasn't meant to be. Underneath the photograph were the printed words, "Matt, our beautiful son and brother. We made a promise to you 9 years, 1 month and 24 days ago to find your body and bring you home. Today, we get to bring you home where you belong. Shine bright in the sky, our gorgeous boy, and fly free with the angels. You can dance all night now without a care. We will never let you be forgotten. Love you now, always and forever. Love Mum, Dad, Pete and Jace." After the search was called off, Matthew's family did not give up. Now, they knew what they had believed all along, that Michael had killed Matthew and buried his body somewhere in that park. In a warning to Michael, they stated, "Atkins, look over your shoulder." In wake of the renewed search, Brisbane's gay community petitioned to nightlife venues in a bid to have Michael banned from the party precinct. He had already been permanently banned from attending the popular nightclub, the Beat Mega Club. The creator of the petition wrote that it was unfair that Michael had been allowed to continue living his normal life and enjoying the freedom of going grocery shopping, going to the gym and going to nightclubs, while Matthew's family were desperately searching for his body. As the petition garnered supporters, Michael was banned from his local gym, as other members threatened to leave if his membership was not terminated. Shortly thereafter, the reward for information that could lead to Matthew's body was increased to $250,000. With the body not found, the inquest into Matthew's disappearance continued. Everybody was ordered back to court in March, where Michael's confession as to what he did to Matthew and where he buried his body was to be unsealed. However, almost as soon as the inquest began, it was adjourned until August. That would be another 5 months in limbo for Matthew's family. In May, the search for Matthew's body was picked back up. Once again, investigators and Matthew's family embarked on the sprawling Royal National Park to search for him. They were focusing on an area known as Waterfall, the same area they had focused on in their earlier searches. It was in this area that Michael said he had buried Matthew's body. The search appeared once again to be unfruitful, but in an astonishing turn of events, just before the search was about to be called off once again, something was discovered buried underneath a tree in the park. The dirt was carefully removed, and upon closer inspection, it soon became apparent that they had unearthed human remains in a 60-centimetre deep grave. It was the moment that Mark and Faye had been waiting for a decade. A decade of uncertainty, a decade of helplessness and hopelessness.
And Scott and Mitch are my heroes, the most humble people, but they found Maddie for me.
Right,
that. Amazing. Amazing. You could not get a more dedicated, professional team that we have at the moment. They are just amazing.
And they wouldn't take no for an answer either.
The remains would be determined to be Matthew via DNA testing. In the wake of the discovery, Mark and Faye lambasted the justice system as flawed. In a statement they said, "They backed us into a corner. They painted us into making a decision to bring our son home and the killer to walk free. We would do it in a heartbeat to get our son back, but our laws have to change. The victims have to have a voice." The discovery was extremely bittersweet for Matthew's loved ones. While his killer had directed them to his body, justice wasn't served. Michael will most likely remain free for life because of a complex web of legal deals. The only way that Michael could be charged was if fresh and compelling evidence was uncovered, and legally, Matthew's body did not constitute as such, because he presented that at the inquest and was protected from prosecution. Matthew's parents spoke with 60 Minutes Australia about the discovery of their son's body.
It's just like a finality. It was like, can't describe it, it was bittersweet. I was happy that we kept our promise to him, but on the same token, it was real. It was very, very real.
Tragically, because so much time had elapsed, a cause of death could not be determined. There was evidence of damage to Matthew's skull and ribs. However, it couldn't be determined if this was caused before or after death. In August, the inquest into Matthew's death resumed. Michael asked to be excused from giving evidence because he had directed investigators to Matthew's body. His request would be approved. As Tim Game, the counsel assisting the inquest, said, "The question of Mr. Atkins' credibility is so compromised, it's difficult to see how the further pursuit of it will assist. We see it as a potentially fruitless task. A high potentially fruitless task." While Michael didn't testify, an investigator read out his version of events as to what happened. According to Michael, he and Matthew had slept in separate rooms after leaving the nightclub. He claimed that when he woke up, Matthew was dead. He alleged that he had found a bottle of GHB in the kitchen and had assumed that Matthew had overdosed on it. He said that he buried Matthew's body because his mother didn't know that he was gay and he felt that he had a reputation to uphold. Michael had described Matthew's death as a problem and that he felt that he would be blamed and shamed. During the inquest, it was revealed that a number of police blunders had essentially led to Michael getting away with murder. Evidence was lost and crucial mistakes were made by investigators when questioning Michael just days after Matthew vanished. Investigators had failed to press Michael with more questions when he was on the verge of giving information. At one point in the interview, Michael had said, "I want to tell you, but I'm scared of what will happen to me if I do." After the testimony was presented, Faye said that she did not believe Michael's version of events. She said, "We will always be left worrying. Did Maddie suffer? Did he die quickly or was it slow and painful? Was he terrified? Did he fight back? Was he smothered with a pillow? Was he held underwater? Did Atkins give Maddie the fatal dose, or just enough in a drink to render him unconscious and then bury him alive? I will go to my grave not knowing what really happened to Maddie." She then produced a photograph of Matthew alongside a photograph of his remains in the mortuary. She thrust it towards Michael's lawyers and told them to look at it, to look at what Michael did to Matthew. New South Wales Deputy State Coroner Elaine Truscott announced that she had no option other than to hand down an open finding on Matthew's death. Too much time had elapsed for a cause of death to be determined, so she could not say without a shadow of a doubt that he was murdered by Michael, although that's what his parents strongly believe. However, the coroner did give a scathing review of Michael and acknowledged that he had some part to play and that he had lied time and time again. He had caused a decade of heartache. On the 10th of March 2018, Matthew Levison was finally brought back home and laid to rest. Mourners were asked to wear purple, which was Matthew's favourite colour, and were encouraged to dance during the service if they wanted to. Songs from ABBA, Celine Dion and Rihanna emanated from the speakers. Mark said to the mourners, "Don't be sad. We have waited for this day for 10 years. His family encouraged people to remember Matthew as the life of the party, the prankster, the dance floor diva, the keen cook and the queen. He was remembered fondly as a sister to every single gay boy between the Shire and the city, especially those trying to find themselves. Most years, Matthew's family march in the gay pride parade in memory of their son.
He could have ended this nightmare for us nearly 10 years ago.
And he chose not to. He played the gamble. He didn't think we were going to keep going. Wrong, mate. Wrong. Wrong family. You took something so dear, so precious, so priceless that we weren't going to give up. We were going to bring our son home.
Most days I have thoughts, evil thoughts towards him. I'm not going to act on those, but I still enjoy my evil thoughts towards him. Just how I cope.
I mean, yeah, you do think, oh, wish, hope this happens to him, hope that happens to him. But as a fantasy, and we're not going to come to his level.
No.
We're not like him. We've got hearts. We care about people. Don't care about him. We've got our son back. We know at whose hand, but we've got our son back, and that's all that matters.
The so-called deal with the devil that Michael Atkins had been offered was the very first in Australian history. To many, it was a slap in the face of justice. In fact, in the wake of the deal, Mark Leveson had the words, "It's not a justice system, it's just a system," etched underneath his tattoo for his son. After 10 long years, Matthew Leveson was returned to his family for a proper burial and gravestone, but not before a celebration of his life. This was all thanks to the unwavering determination of a loving mother and father. While the discovery of a body in many murder cases can lead to some semblance of closure, there is no real closure for the Leveson family. Each and every single day, they are forced to live with the reminder that their son's killer is free while their son is in the ground. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Kylie Gurley, Marley Abeda, Mia Edwards, and Laura Fraser. The support on Patreon truly goes such a long way. It helps to defray the costs of Freedom of Information requests, archive subscriptions, hosting, and much more. In return, you get monthly exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms. Early release episodes, ad-free episodes, true crime articles, polls, and you can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. You can also sign up annually and get 15% off. Big thank you to everybody who has simply listened to an episode as well. The support is very much appreciated. If you didn't know already, I have a new investigative true crime series called The Shattered Window. It uncovers an unsolved murder as well as a wrongful conviction over the course of 10 episodes. Please make sure to subscribe to The Shattered Window wherever you're listening now. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Moms and Murder. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Chickens, Diet Coke, reality TV, and murder don't seem like things that should go together, but somehow they do. If you're looking for your next binge-worthy podcast and you like your true crime light on the gore, then you should check out our show, Moms and Murder, a true crime podcast hosted by myself, Mandy, and my dear friend, Melissa.
Each week, we give our take on a new crime story, balancing our delivery of facts and levity while still giving the stories the respect they deserve and making you feel like you're part of our conversation. Moms and Murder covers both the lesser known and the more familiar stories, and there are over 100 episodes to binge, so get started now. Search Moms and Murder on your favorite podcast app and subscribe so you never miss an episode.